We've already ruined this. Try again.
Yeah, try again. You didn't know what you were getting into, Kate.
No, I didn't. Like... This is Music Respawn. I'm Kate Remington, and today I've got the great pleasure of talking with Jason Graves and Austin Wintry, and man, it is so much fun to catch up with both of you.
Good luck getting a word in edgewise, but it's great to speak with you too, Kate.
Yeah, I love the ominous laughter that immediately. It's great to talk, Jason, immediately.
Well, you guys have a concert coming up on February 12th. It's the American Youth Symphony in L.A., and this just sounds like such a cool idea because it's music from The Order 1886 and Journey and The Last Guardian, along with the Stravinsky Firebird Suite and Britten's 4C Interludes. And I guess just for openers, you know, this is not the kind of concert, as far as I know, that happens every day. So how did this all get put together?
Do you know more than I do, Austin, since you're in L.A. with Sony?
I can take a crack at it. The little bit of backstory with the American Youth Symphony is that they have somewhat of a precedent for doing this kind of thing, though never before, to my knowledge, with game music. But for example, they did a 3-year thing they called the Jerry Goldsmith Project, and they also did a 3-year thing called the Danny Elfman Project, where they would do a concert that was split down the middle between highlights of scores from each of them, and then also classical repertoire that they thought formed kind of an interesting dialogue with those pieces. So like for Jerry Goldsmith, I remember they did the 3 concerts once per season were kind of dividing the career into 3 chapters. And so like the early Goldsmith was the first year, and they had the Planet of the Apes, the hunt sequence on there, which is just this burly, you know, pretty progressive mid-20th century kind of piece. And I can't for the life of me remember what they paired it with, but a similar kind of piece from the concert repertoire of that time, if I recall, things like that. So I always thought it was really cool. Of course, there's a lot of like hardcore film music Goldsmith fanboys in the audience that are going, why are you putting all this classical shit on the show? But I liked that. And I also liked it because even though I simultaneously recognize that this is stupid, part of me always enjoys when this art that we work in gets a little bit of validation in the sort of ivory tower classical space. And because the American Youth Symphony is, you know, they're a youth orchestra, but they're overwhelmingly a classical group. So it's always cool that not only are they saying, hey, it's worth performing this music, but alongside the repertoire. So they just decided to do it with games. And I guess Sony said, well, you know, I don't know when the dialogue started directly with Sony, but the whole idea of making it a concert featuring all Sony exclusives came about because then I got a call from David Newman, he's not conducting this show, but he's kind of the, I can't remember what his exact title is with the orchestra, but he's kind of their big cheerleader and a liaison to a lot of the stuff that they want to get done for, especially film music stuff, where he can call, you know, various people around town or copyists and get a hold of scores and parts. And that's what he was after here, too. He basically said, is there performance material available for this stuff? Beginning that process. But by the time Sony approached me, they said, you know, here's what we're thinking for the program. And they already had Jason's work on The Order in mind. And so there wasn't ever even a brainstorm of what music should it be. It was just like, here's the thing. Are you in or you out? Of course, it wasn't. Wasn't a hard,
yeah,
wasn't
for
a hard
sure.
Question.
So, did you guys make your own arrangements of the pieces from the scores, or was that already done for you by somebody else?
No, I think remote control handled most of it for all of us.
And
all
right, I used one of my lifelines.
No, you say what you did, Austin, because I don't know. We actually haven't talked about this, so I'm learning a lot here too.
Well, my answer is super fast because the main pieces from Journey that get performed, the parts of the score that lend themselves best to it are kind of the finale and the main theme, what on the album is called Nascence, Apotheosis, and I Was Born for This. And because the game's been out for 5 years and there have been a lot of requests to perform it in situations, you know, kind of like this or video games live or things like that, I had score and parts already. I've had them for years. So I basically just said, here, and then I was done. It was like, it was a non-thing, you know. The Order is a far more recent score, so I think, Jason, you had a lot more to do at it. Like, you actually had work to do, I think, for this.
Here's my background to the concert. I worked really closely with Peter Scaturro on The Order 1886, which was, what, 2 years ago, I think. And even back then, he was talking about really wanting to push something with Sony for having live performances of their music. And I'm not sure who else was involved, but I know that, Pete was a big proponent behind it. Even when we met at the Sony event that was in Las Vegas at the end of 2015, I think it was, he was making headroads then, trying to do more for the concert stage. And he's the one that contacted me back last fall and pretty much said, okay, cool, we're doing it. We're going to work with the American Youth Symphony, and you know, we want to do The Order. Do you think that's something that can be done? Because the original recordings were 18 violas, 12 cellos, and 6 basses, plus 12 contrabassoons and contrabass clarinets. So it's not exactly your standard stage orchestra. And what I discussed with Pete, and as usual, they were just like, that sounds great, go for it. But I said, instead of trying to recreate that sound that we got very specifically for the game on stage and have 2/3 of the orchestra just sitting there not doing anything, I think we should do an arrangement that really respects the stage orchestra, a performance arrangement that's live that everyone can hear, and we just make it sound as great as we can with a big full orchestra. So there was, you know, we didn't have violins in the recording, for example. Well, I wasn't going to let them sit out. So there's violins, there's trumpets, there's French horns. It was pretty much just a severe augmentation of what I had recorded. And the score is fairly simple. It's just 3 parts, really. A melody, a contra melody, and a bass line. So it's just lots of doubling, more or less. And then I moved the choir. We had a live choir for The Order. That's mostly French horns and trombones. So it was just moving things from one instrument to another, adding some percussion, making sure that it still had the right spirit, but in a much more grandiose, full orchestral setting.
You know, echoing what we said to Sony, I remember when they first talked to me about, you know, being part of The Order with Jason and you know, that those early days. I remember, generally speaking, collaborative work like co-scoring is not really something I seek out, and I've been offered situations before that I passed on because I was like, I don't think that, frankly, it's just I don't think it's terribly compatible with the way I like to work, and I would hate to give you kind of a lesser version of what I hope to offer you. So I tend to bow, but I remember when they brought it up, it was like, of all people that you could possibly name to pair me with, because, you know, Jason had been attached to The Order since they first dreamt of it. I remember saying, of all human beings in this industry, he's the only one that I would just go charging into it with enthusiasm to do. So that's why this concert is such a natural, you know, fantastic thing.
Thank you.
these kids must be amazing, because this is like a really heavy-duty program.
They are astonishing.
Did you suggest the Britain? Isn't there a Britain piece?
Yeah, the sea interludes. Yeah.
Was that one of your suggestions?
It was, yeah.
I knew it!
I don't know if TK, you know, Takeshi Furukawa from The Last Order's Last Journey, I don't know if he suggested something or if they had figured it out before they had his details firmed up or something, but I know I was also equally completely unsurprised by the Firebird. But I loved that idea that it was like asking us specifically, what are some works that you know, that inspire you in a general sense, and not that they directly inspired like Journey or The Order or The Last Guardian, but just are part of your DNA as a composer. And to me, Britain is one of my senior ranking council of elders, and the 4C interlude. I love Peter Grimes, and for the longest time, it was like the only opera that I would acknowledge as a good piece of dramatic theater, because I just have such an allergy to so much opera as a narrative experience. It's the classic, like, great music, terrible libretto feeling. But Peter Grimes I've always loved, and 4C Interludes is an amazing extraction from that. And so I tossed that out there with a list of other things, and I was so happy when they came back to it. So, or when they agreed to it, rather.
Well, it was neat because Go ahead, Kate. I was just saying, it's been a while since I've heard it. And man, as soon as that Dawn part started, I could hear so much Abzu and Journey in there with that kind of open sound and stuff. So yeah.
Well, I am a hack, so it should be really transparent.
Same thing with me and the Stravinsky. The Firebird Suite was one of the ones that I suggested, along with a couple of other things that I'm glad they didn't pick, because I was having problems finding something that would be an appropriate length. It's like, well, no, we can't do like the entire first movement of Tchaikovsky's Fifth or whatever. It just, you know,
your recommendation was Mahler 9.
Yeah, the whole thing. That and the ring cycle. And I don't know why they wouldn't do it.
What it really interests me, and I would love to hear, I'm just going to take your, you don't even need to talk anymore, Kate. I would love to hear your opinion on this, Austin, because I love the idea of work that we've done in a studio. And for me, like 15 minutes from The Order, I was doing it under central crunch. I was basically doing 3 minutes a day, like, you know, 6 weeks before the recording session. So the music that I did that's going to be in this suite, I literally did in like 5, maybe 6 days. And that was working on it. And by the end of the day, I had an orchestrated cue from Paul, my copyist. So we're comparing literally 6 days of work from Jason Graves to, I should have Googled this, to however many years Stravinsky spent on the Firebird, plus being, you know, working with the ballet and doing everything else. And I think it's an interesting apples to oranges comparison. That's the it's the quintessential media music versus stage music kind of thing. What we're beholden to, how much time we have to do it. A lot of people negate the quality of film, TV, or game music because, you know, it's done so quickly. How do you feel about that, Mr. Wintery?
Yeah, the speed thing is always a an automatic tick against the perceived integrity of the art, which is obviously stupid because there's plenty of, you know, examples of, like, you know, Prokofiev and Mozart and others writing, you know, symphonies in inside of a month. I've always thought it's a little unfair. But nonetheless, I'm trying to give an answer while also scamming through the Wikipedia page on the Firebird to see if I can get an answer. I'm sure it's here, but I'm just doing a terrible job of multitasking. In any case, Journey is interesting because, like Nascence, which is, I mean, it's 90 seconds long, and two-thirds of that is solo cello and solo flute. So it's like, it's hardly complicated. But that was written in an afternoon. That was written in an hour because they pitched the idea for the game, and then I sang the basics of it into my phone, and then I basically transcribed it, and I had Tina Guo, the cello player, and Amy Tatum, the flute player, at my studio about 90 minutes later and tracked it and then added the strings with samples, which were replaced like 2 years later, and sent it back to them to say, here's what I'm thinking for a theme. And they said, yeah, it works. Let's just keep going and you know, kind of just moved on from there and never changed anything or anything. I mean, literally even the voicings of the strings and everything are exactly as they were. And so it's a hyper compressed turnaround. Apotheosis is a little bit more like the classical tradition insofar as I wasn't constantly rewriting it because I hated it. Although that incidentally, I largely did, but it was because we were trying to figure out the right feel for the game, and the game itself kept constantly changing, so the needs of those cues were also changing a lot. And so that was like months of that 7 minutes or whatever that particular selection is comprised of. That is many months or maybe even the better part of a year worth of iteration. But it's also deceptive because it's not like that one 7 minutes is the only thing I obsessively worked on for a year. And so it's you know, when all is said and done, it's probably dozens or, you know, maybe 100 hours spread out over the course of a year worth of constant changes, which is more than normal for sure. Cause yeah, I mean, like on Assassin's Creed, it was the same thing as Jason was talking about where, you know, 2 weeks before going to Abbey Road, I was like, oh, hey, there's still like a half hour of music to write. It was, you know, the crazy crunch. Journey, fortunately, was so spread out that there wasn't much of that. I Was Born for This was also similarly pretty fast turnaround, but I waited until the 11th hour to write it because I was like, I don't feel comfortable writing the end credits until I feel like the whole score is figured out. And Apotheosis was such a question mark for so long that I kept stalling and stalling and stalling. And of course the team were like, you're going to put a thing with like vocals and at the end, like, isn't this just going to feel like an anime? And they were very skeptical. And thank God, there was no time, I think, to do anything different by the time I delivered it. So thank God they liked it.
You know, that's a great method that I've used before, where I wasn't sure towards the end of a project if something would get approved because it was for an end credit or for maybe the final little movies that were going to play in the game or something. And I just waited until the last minute to deliver it, so they didn't really have time to make any corrections. They're like, you know what? We don't have time to change it, so we're just going to drop it in. I'm like, oh, okay, sure. Yes.
Well, it's a really amazing way to avoid ever being hired by that person again.
Well, only if it sucks.
Okay, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, you know, there are plenty of examples of, well, like Beethoven with the third piano concerto. He didn't even write down his piano part because there wasn't time. And the poor page turner had to turn all these blank pages. You know, Beethoven would like, nod, okay, turn here. And so, you know, there are lots and lots of examples from the classical world too, and nobody disses them. So
there's another famous one of that this surely isn't true, but I'm going to pretend it is, and we can edit out the part where I say, surely this isn't true, where Vivaldi, you know, he was a teacher at this school for girls, and a lot of his writing was for the like student orchestra. And so I think why so much of it was just obviously kind of purely for strings. He supposedly he would write so fast that the copyist sitting next to him, who would be transcribing the parts to distribute to the orchestra, couldn't. He would write faster than the copyist could verbatim just repeat what he was writing onto the page. That's like this apocryphal little story I read in some book at some point of literally it would stream out of him faster than somebody could non-compositionally duplicate it. Like as in they are not having to be creative. And I always thought, you know, like I hope that's true just because it's like one for our side. It's a point for our half of this.
Well, also I was listening to the Firebird and the Infernal Dance this time, because of the context of this concert, it really struck me that it would make great boss battle music. You know, like a, like, you know, one of those sort of wounded Dark Souls, big old knights with a huge sword and kind of thing. And so, you know, the curtain between the music you guys write and classical music is really very thin. And so that's what I think is so great about this concert.
One of the things I love about Austin's writing is he, whether it's intentional or not, he wears his heart on his sleeve. You can just, I haven't talked with anyone else about this, but I can hear the lyricism and the inventiveness and sort of stream of conscious composing that is not done today, that was done by classical composers, still being done by classical composers now, but a lot of media composers, what I hear are just four-bar phrases because they're recording to loops or they're recording to pre-done just phrases that it just all goes four bars at a time. And that's not a very classical thing. You know, when I think of the kind of melodies that I love, like Tchaikovsky, where it just kind of, it's just pouring out emotion, and you get caught up in the emotion of the phrase, and it's very, very musical, and it's a lot more effective, I think, because it's not this sort of sterile, like, you know, dum, 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 you're not stuck in this constant loop. And that's, I've always thought, even when the first time we met, Austin, we spent like a day together at your studio, that as much as you love Goldsmith, I hear a lot more classical influence, maybe with shades of Goldsmith, in the kind of stuff that you write. So that's why I love that Journey's on the concert, and then you've got the Britain stuff going on. That's really cool.
Well, that's really, I definitely don't stand down from the accusation of kind of wearing my heart on my sleeve, and trying to make. I remember Leonard Bernstein once said that, like, I'm paraphrasing because I can't remember exactly what the quote was, but he was essentially saying that the best music, it's a very non-spontaneous act to write music, because it's time and labor intensive, and, you know, a minute of music can take a day to write, depending on the kind of stuff. And, you know, like Jason's Dead Space stuff is the kind of stuff that, like, does not just, you don't just pour that out of you, or at least I couldn't. But yet, the best writing should feel like this spontaneous burst of inspiration. Like, it should somehow feel like it just popped into existence whole cloth. And so the act of writing is often this act of fighting against yourself to not get too obsessed with all the nitty-gritty, like, patting yourself on the back over your super sexy contrapuntal technique and voice leading and blah, 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 because you get in the way of letting that spontaneity through. And I've always struggled with that, because I always loved, like, I was a nerd for the theory and orchestration and all that stuff. And so it's like, ooh, I spend an hour on what if the flute is, you know, flutter tonguing or not. And like stuff that can really derail the big picture. And you should, like, maybe look at on a second pass through it or something. I don't know. But point is, I do try to be sort of a hopeless romantic, even if the music is, like, nasty and full of teeth and gruesome, unlike Journey, obviously. To that end, though, since Jason got to talk about me, I'll get to talk about him. Because in a similar manner, Jason's deep running instincts as a percussionist are, to me, one of the single biggest standouts of his writing. And because I was actually just having a conversation with a friend about this, and specifically talking about Dead Space and how, like, you know, as much as we talk about aleatoric scores like Altered States of John Corigliano or things like that, that might have served in some capacity as the inspiration for Dead Space, for me, what makes it really its own thing, in definite contrast to those other works that one would think to point to as inspiration, is that the entire orchestra has been converted into a percussion instrument. And I don't think that's true of Corigliano, for example. Like Altered States, the sacrificial dances, that music is the orchestra in a nasty caveman kind of behavior, but it's not, every single member of the orchestra is not being told, you have mallets in your hand right now. And when I listen to Dead Space, the reason why it still, like, just beats the shit out of me is because it's everyone behaving like that. And only a percussionist could have, I couldn't have done that. Only a percussionist could have done that. And it's freaking amazing. It's why, to me, that's part of what makes what Jason did on The Order so interesting, because I feel like it required, you like, there's like no percussion in The Order. And to the extent that there is, it's coloristic, you know, kind of creepy things and less that propulsive quality. But that nonetheless changes what you did. You still are going to write with that same approach. So to me, it's so fascinating, because most composers, you know, like, a lot of composers are either guitarists or pianists, and you can totally hear that. And it kind of, I don't know, to me, you have a lot of baggage to overcome when that's your starting position, because it's like, here's the right hand, here's the left hand, here are my bar chords, in an orchestrated fashion. And to say, no, that's not how I'm thinking. I'm thinking with sticks and mallets in my hand, and the idea that every object in sight is an instrument. That's a totally different outlook that is not common amongst composers, and I find very refreshing.
Yeah.
I love you say percussionist and not drummer. I always call myself a drummer because that's just – I am a percussionist, but I don't know. Drummer somehow sounds
Drummer's the bad boy version. Percussionists wear tuxedos.
Yeah, yeah.
Drummers have like torn sleeves and jeans, and percussionists wear tuxes. And I guess I'm just putting you on a pedestal that you clearly don't think you deserve. So you're right. You're right. Point rescinded. You're a drummer.
Okay, that works.
But yeah, there's this freedom of, you know, anything is possible with the sounds that you use, Jason. It's just really amazing. And you've said a bunch of times that The Order is one of your favorite scores. And can you kind of pinpoint why that is?
Probably. So, you know, it's funny. Austin says he sees baggage with a guitar player or a piano player. Of course, I saw baggage, I mean, until maybe 6 or 7 years ago, being a drummer. And I definitely was a drummer back then because I didn't have any real percussion instruments around. It wasn't like I could break out my vibes and go jam with some folks. It just, I mostly had drums. And I was writing for this giant orchestra with this drummer brain and felt like I was at an extreme disadvantage. I needed to learn more about orchestration and harmony and melody, and spent a lot of time working on all that, especially orchestration. I just love the idea of different instruments, different timbres combining certain ways. And that's where The Order just ticked that box for me, because we had so much time to brainstorm things. And, you know, Austin and I collaborated on the theme, and we worked together a lot just throwing ideas back and forth in terms of instruments that we'd be able to use for the theme. And it just came down to, I felt like we were almost unconsciously one-upping each other, trying to see how much of the orchestra could get thrown out and still have some sort of a feasible score. And I think that's why it's still my favorite, because Sony just put their hands up and walked away. Not in frustration. I'm holding my hands up like I'm not touching anything. And they walked away. Yeah. So that's how I ended up at Abbey Road with, you know, 18 violas and all those low winds and male choir and all that stuff.
Wow. Yeah, it's just an amazing score just because of that sound and how it just really encapsulates the whole mood of the game. And does it help when the people at the studio, the devs, are like really riding you and throwing out ideas, or is it easier to just have them leave you to your own devices and see what happens?
I guess that would depend on the end result. If they left me in my own devices and we got to the session and they didn't like anything, I would have wished that they would have ridden me and let me know. I think my ultimate goal, and Austin's probably the exact same way, is I want to satisfy myself, but almost more importantly than that, I want to make sure the developers are happy with what I'm doing. Because I'm, you know, Austin and I are interpreting their vision just the way a film composer would. You know, they've spent all this time on this project and now we're putting music on it, which can completely change depending on the kind of music you put on the scene. It's going to completely change the emotion of the scene, and we want to make sure we're playing it the way that the developers originally intended. Now, in my opinion, and I keep saying, I might as well just say R like the royal we, because I always say, I'm assuming Austin's going to think, we're like two peas in a pod, but I think the best kind of relationship is one that's collaborative, and the developer or the director or whoever it is that you're working with wants to really know what we as composers think would work. Like, here's my idea, but I want you to contribute, I want you to put your stamp on it, and we're going to make this thing together. Together we're going to have, you know, such a better project than it would have been if we were doing it separately. And then we kind of encourage each other. And in my experience, it's really been more of a upping the ante and just increasing the level of excitement and creativity on both sides of the road. It usually is not backwards. I always think, and I tell them at the beginning, my job is to push this so far into a new creative space that you're going to go, okay, that was great, and this last one is a little too much. Let's just pull it back a little bit. And they never say that. They never say that.
Yeah, I definitely echo. I mean, per Jason's point, it's rare that I'll be like, no. We do tend to see things very similarly. I tend to feel very nervous if I'm getting no feedback, because sometimes that means that they're really busy, and they're kind of giving it this cursory glance. And then sometime later, when you've kind of moved on, they're going to be like, oh, by the way, I have a lot of notes. And it can be really hard to kind of reverse course back into, especially if you've built up this kind of trellis based around the assumption that that was working. You know, like imagine if on the order it had been, you know, a year later, like, oh, you know, I am I not hearing violins, or what's up with that? And it's like there's like a mountain of cues written without, you know, you'd be like, well, okay, wait a minute, we have to address a kind of systemic problem. And because I've had it both ways, where you know, there's a huge amount of iteration, but it feels like a good workout at the gym, where you think, you know, yes, great idea, really good note, you're right, that it is much better now for doing it XYZ way instead. And it's not like they're tampering with your vision, they're helping you get better and do the best version of whatever it is you're trying to do. Because ultimately the best version can be defined as that which exists at the cross section of your vision and theirs. And they have to like help, you know, triangulate that coordinates for that with you. But I've had, you know, like Assassin's Creed Syndicate was actually very similar to Jason's experience on the order in that way, where I got basically no notes and there's some stuff in there that I'm to this day astonished made it through the chain of command. The first time I wrote combat music, they had a note that, and I reeled that cue back in because it was just like pretty intense and dissonant, and they were like, okay, well, this is kind of stressing us out. Like, they put it in the build and we played some combat, and it was like instantly anxiety inducing. And it was like, okay. And I realized, oh, you know what? It should be fun. And that's when I started experimenting with the idea of combat as these waltzes. And then from that point forward, there's not a single note. Other note that came up was there was one cue that was like this very tiny little insert cue where they said, is it big enough? And I said, I think the mock-up is not doing justice to how much I can make the orchestra really lean into it. So they said, okay, then that's fine. And so then I just like marked it fortissimo on the score instead of forte, and that was it. And because literally every other 3.5 hours of music, and that was the feedback. And so part of me just kept waiting for the other shoe to drop, and then for them to be like, there's just no chance to fix all this. We just have to bail and go hire somebody else. I mean, I almost – part of me was so sure that that would happen that I, like, wouldn't be shocked if I still got that call. And it's like, we're patching the game.
We're replacing your entire score.
Yeah. Like, on On further reflection, you know, for the 2-year anniversary of the release of the game, we're releasing a special collector's edition, you know, done right, and we, you know.
Oh yeah, Austin, did I not tell you they called me? Sorry about that.
Yeah, right. Good. No, at least it'll be a good score then.
That was exactly my experience with Ubisoft doing Far Cry. And we had, I had some initial experimentation with instruments and things. And once I sort of settled in on what I wanted and really started delivering music, they were just like, when are you going to send the next cue? Keep it coming, keep it coming, keep it coming. Which was great. It was fantastic working with them.
You know, the thing that I get from both of you is just this, just enthusiasm. And it's fun. I mean, it's probably not fun all the time, but it really seems like most of the time it is. And that's what's so cool about this concert, because, you know, finding music that kids really want to play is so important to kind of keep them going, because, you know, learning an instrument is really, really tough. And unless you find a way to make it fun for them, you know, they give up. They kind of throw in the towel. So I think that's one of the cool things, really, that is going to be fun for the kids on the concert.
And I love that they have The Last Guardian on there, too. It's gotten a lot of attention this year, and I think that's going to be... I mean, that Journey was such a huge hit, and I know that The Order wasn't as well received as the developers had hoped, and it was a little disappointing for all of us that spent so much hard work on such a beautiful game. So that might not be the one that the kids really sit up and they're like, oh, I love Galahad's theme. But you've got two other pieces that actually contrast really, really well, and the order of the sequence for the program that night is really cool, and I love that we have a Q&A beforehand, and I love that the concert's free. Anybody can show up.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. And I was thinking back to what it was that kind of really got me fired up about taking piano lessons, and it was, I've been playing for, I don't know, a few months, and I heard the student finishing up ahead of me playing for Elisa, and I was like, oh my God, I have to learn how to play that. And it like opened up this world. It was amazing. And Austin, I just found out that was a piece that you learned right off the bat too. Of course, you had a little more incentive than I did.
I was wondering if you knew that story, because I was sitting there, as soon as you said that just now, I thought, well, that's pretty hilarious coincidence. Well, the short version, I don't know if Jason knows this story, strangely. This is like the last piece of information that Jason doesn't know about me.
Yeah, write it down.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's probably not worth that. But the short version is that when I was a kid, my dad discovered music was not a part of my life at all, and my dad discovered this air rifle in his mother's basement that had been his when he was a kid in like the 50s. Of course I wanted it. Now this thing would never be legal now. It was like it's like a rifle. I mean, it's a kid's killing machine. And so I mean, it's a pellet gun where you pump it full of air, but you can pump a lot of air and make a pretty serious projectile out of it. And it takes BBs and pellets, and you can put darts in it, which of course I did. So I said, I want it. And my dad, in this totally bizarre bit of apparent parenting genius, said, if you learn to play Beethoven's Für Elise, you can have this. I had never taken piano lessons. Music wasn't a part of my life at all, but I was like, I'll do whatever the hell I have to do. And so I had been plunking around on the piano because I had figured out that the little glockenspiels we were learning in school, this was like fifth grade for me, in school, these little glockenspiels that they were teaching us things like Ode to Joy on, I realized, oh, the layout is the same as the piano. So I started playing things with one finger just kind of because it was fun. That was the extent of my musical vocabulary, is, you know, rote memorization and imitation with no concept for what the music was or anything. And but I got this piano teacher who agreed to teach me Für Elise. And so within like 3 weeks of starting piano, I was able to play it to get this pellet gun. And my teacher was like, what the hell just happened? And he said, do you actually want to learn piano? Or was this just this bizarre exercise in getting a... Because it's not like I could play piano. I could make my fingers imitate his in the pattern necessary to play this. I couldn't read music. I was 100% just, I want this gun, and this is the weird dance I have to do to get it. And so, but it was, that's all it took, is once it had the hooks in, I was like, oh, wow. I loved the interaction with the keys, you know, and I loved that just that little basic start made me, you know, feel like I've just kind of cracked open this box and there's tons of goodies inside. And so anyway, yeah, off it went. But to one point that I wanted to, when you mentioned the kids and the youth orchestra and that whole thing, the thing that I also love about this concert is that I think the age cap for the AYS is 22, if I recall, somewhere around there. So there's like kids that are in middle school through to college age kids, basically. So the age range, that's always what's fun because I go to their shows a lot. And when I look at the orchestra, there'll be like children that practically look like they could be the parents of other kids in the orchestra. Like they are very nearly capable of being that, because there'll be kids that are like 9 and then there's kids that are like 22. and it's like, it's like just a few more years and this is a viable split. Not that we would necessarily advocate for that, but the point is, like, there's a huge range. Like, a 9-year-old and a 20-year-old look like completely different. You know, it's a lot different than a 20-year-old next to a 30-year-old or a 30-year-old next to a 40-year-old. I mean, you really look like you just recently graduated from infancy at that age. And I love that, you know, but you have to be good. Like, it's a good orchestra, and so their age is not an automatic declaration of their talent. And what I love is that they're being exposed to totally different kinds of music, modern composers of different media, obviously, beyond the concert hall. And then that gets to be a part of their formative experiences as a musician. And they are not, because they have to be good, which means that they are, you know, probably all in some kind of rigorous training, or maybe even, you know, things like the Colburn School, where, you know, you get pretty rigorous conservatory style training for really young kids and things like that, where so often there's this brainwashing that takes place of what it means to be a classical musician, to play the violin, to play the trumpet, to play the cello, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they are being spared that by participating in our culture. And to me, that's how you, quote, save the classical world, is that the orchestras themselves need to hunger for this music. Because they'll play it if they want to play it. You know, because, you know, I don't think it's possible for an audience to not buy into an enthusiastic performance. But so often the reason why contemporary music, no matter what media we're talking about, whether it's contemporary concert music or film music or video game music, so often the reason why that's resisted or cynically placed in Pops concerts is because the orchestra themselves don't even like doing it. They just do it because they see it as this Faustian way to get audiences in there. But it's not like the audience is going to leave feeling, you know, super jazzed if they're looking at the orchestra kind of all slumped over. But if they grew up playing this, to them it's just part of what the word music entails. And that's huge. And I love that so much.
Yeah. And the other thing is, the kids in the audience, because you know there's going to be a bunch of them, will see just how relevant and, you know, contemporary this orchestra can be. And so you probably pick up a lot of new fans for music and kids who get excited enough that they want to pick up an instrument and they want to do that too. So, I mean, I would imagine that's one of, hopes. Yeah. So, Jason, what about you? What was like the way in to music for you?
Oh my gosh.
Do you remember?
I'll just say, like, everything that Austin just said. No, literally, my
play
mom Furley played piano.
On the drums.
Yeah, and I on the drums. Oh my gosh. Doom 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 doom. I didn't have that many tom-toms. We had an upright piano in the house growing up, and you know, with the stool that lifted up and had the music inside of it.
Oh yeah.
And for Elise, I don't remember how I heard it, but I remember just picking it out by ear. My best friend that lived behind me also had a piano, and she was taking piano lessons. And that was my first kind of experience. It was just the ba 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 ba, just probably playing it very clunkily and probably not the exact right notes, but picking that out, because what's so great, it's so compartmentalized and short and simple, but powerful. Everything that any composer would aspire to write. I took piano lessons for, I don't know, maybe it was a year in middle school. That's when I started tinkering with the piano. But I quit because my teacher, who was the organist at our church, made me say the notes out loud when I played them, and I didn't want to do that. And then I moved. This was in Florida. We moved to North Carolina, and it turns out the organist also moved to the same church that we were going to in North Carolina. And in high school, I started taking piano lessons again. And the first thing he said, he put up his hands and said, "I promise I won't make you say the notes," as soon as I walked in. But I was taking piano lessons then and, you know, just kind of trying to broaden my horizons a little bit, because I was also taking percussion lessons on snare drum and mallets and things like that. But that was my gateway. That was my entrance as well, was the Beethoven piece.
Wow, that's amazing. I switched to cello for a while in like fifth grade, and I really, really wanted to play, but our Irish setter would like sing along. And so...
Sing is an awfully generous word.
Yeah, well... So after that, it was back to the piano. But yeah, you know, I think it's really great when parents, you know, support the kids and, you know, give them all the help that they need without, you know, a whole lot of pressure, and just keep it fun, I guess, really.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why I appreciated my parents not saying in middle school, "Well, he's your teacher, and if he wants you to say the names of the notes, you're taking lessons, you're going to say the names of the notes." They were just like, "Well, if you don't want to do it, then that's fine." And I took drum lessons in middle school as well. So I just focused more on drums then. But my folks were the impetus behind everything I do. They were always, and still are, always supporting me. And, you know, my dad wanted me to do what I love for a living. For a while, he was stuck in some jobs that he felt he needed to do because they paid well and it was decent jobs and he could support his family that way. And, didn't want me, I think, to have the same sort of frustration. And that's the only reason I'm still, or even began, doing what I'm doing. Because if my parents had pushed me towards a quote-unquote real job, that's what I would be doing. And I'd be doing some fun little music things on the side at night, or playing in a band or whatever. And that's all totally great. I'm not knocking that at all. But that is not the same as being able to sit down and just, you know, have fun, have so much fun. The biggest test for me is always, if you had bajillions of dollars, if you didn't need to make money, what would you be doing? I'd be doing exactly what I'm doing now, because I'm not doing it for the money. I'm doing it because I love it, and that's why it's so fulfilling for me.
Yeah, I'm really grateful to my parents too. They rolled their eyes a little bit when I said, "You know what, I want to go to music school, I want to be a piano major," but they never said, "Really?" I don't think that's a great idea.
I think even my wife's parents, when we got engaged, I was out of college, but I was going to USC in Los Angeles for more music school, and they were both, her mom was a little more excited because she was a liberal arts major. Her dad was a little more conservative, and they both are super nice, and they both loved us to death. But there was definitely a, you know, the sort of dad like, "So you're going to marry a musician, honey." sort of thing. And I think even once we left, we were going out, we announced that we were going to get married and we went to dinner or something like that. And then I know my father-in-law looked at my mother-in-law and was like, "They're going to be living in our house in 6 months." Actually, we did live at their house. That was the irony. Once I got out of school, I was in LA for a while and just decided it wasn't for me. So we moved back home and crashed with them for about 6 months. So his prophecy did come true. It just was a little later.
That's even better.
It's been so much fun talking with both of you guys, and I think this concert is going to be a really amazing experience for everybody involved. And wow, I mean, thanks so much for spending some time and talking about it, and you know, all these little backstories about what's important about music for you guys too.
Totally my pleasure.
And I can close with a definitive answer on the Firebird. I have not been paying any attention at all. I've just been trying to get the answer to the Firebird. But I have it. And actually, as soon as I read it, I realized I remembered details to this it jogged my memory, rather, on details, which was that Diaghilev originally approached a much more famous composer, who I don't think it's someone who's famous to us now, but was known at the time, and I don't remember who it was, and it doesn't say who they were here, but, you know, a composer who was considered a bigger name. And then the story is that when he checked in with them a few months before that needed to be complete so they could begin rehearsals, the composer hadn't even started yet. And so Diaghilev freaked out, fired him, and then took a chance on this young guy who was 27 at the time, in case you want to feel really shitty, and gave him the commission. So the answer on how long it took to write the Firebird was that Stravinsky received the commission and began working in December of 1909 and delivered the finished ballet May of 1910. So all things told, 5 months.
Wow.
Which is kind of amazing.
Which, yeah, to write like a seminal work of the canon of music.
Not bad.
Yeah. And so there you go. There we finally have our answer. And I feel I would have called back, insisted we all get back on the Skype and all that if I had not been able to determine that, because that should be memorized information anyway.
Hey, I already looked it up. I just wasn't going to say anything.
Oh, I see. And meanwhile, Jason has all this trivia ready to go about 4C interludes. But we're out of time, so thank you so much.
Yeah, that's right.